Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Karen Cam Radio Show, and the intention of the show is to empower and inspire you to manifest the life of your dreams, whether it's radiant health, prosperity, loving relationships, or simply peace of mind. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Cam, author of the number one bestseller, Guide to Healing Chronic Pain, A Holistic Approach. If you don't have a copy of my book, you can get the first six chapters as a free download, as well as the whole table of contents, of course, from my website just by signing up for my mailing list. Just go to www.karencan.com, and then when you put your email and name in there, I'll actually send you a link to get five of my Fast Track Your Healing webinar classes absolutely free, as well as my gift to you. And please join me on my website. I'm also, connected to Facebook and Pinterest and the whole bit. I'm probably the most active on Facebook, so if you want to know the latest news, or how I did on my skating show yesterday, you'll see it on Facebook. but today it's going to be fun, very, very fun, because it's been a while now. I've been wanting to get the folks, from this wonderful place, the Center for Nonviolent Communication, on the show, because, one of the missions that I have is really connecting people to each other and supporting them and having loving relationships. And I know how difficult it is sometimes to know how to communicate. So many people say, I have trouble communicating, or my husband doesn't communicate, or I don't know how to talk to my kids, or we always get into a fight. And how common is that? I mean, that is a very common human experience, not to be able to communicate well. And I've worked really, really hard, to communicate and learn to communicate, because I was really shy as a child. And pretty much, verbally shut down. I was scared to death, really, of talking and speaking and sharing how I feel. And so I have trained so hard in this, and it's really made a huge difference in my relationships, and I keep working on it. And when I heard about the work of Marshall Rosenberg and nonviolent communication and heard some training calls, I was so impressed and amazed by the languaging that they were using, especially talking to kids, young kids even. And even though I, haven't studied it in great detail, just that little bit of training and learning has helped me immensely. So, instead of, asking, one of my child patients why they were instead of saying, well, you were misbehaving, that was bad or good, or, judging it somehow, I asked them how they felt about something. And, for example, one of my, teen kids, recently, I just, brand new person, I didn't really know her, but she looked a little dark, and I had a suspicion that she probably is very, very sensitive. And so I just asked her, is there anything you saw or heard when you were a child that other people couldn't see or hear? And her big, eyes got really big, and she was like, oh my God. She's like, I saw spirits. And I'm like, oh, really? Well, can you tell me what that's like? And, and then it was like, well, what happened when you told your mother? And she goes, well, she was saying, well, it's okay. And she didn't really do anything. And I said, so it sounds like you felt a little upset. Is that true? And she's like, well, yeah, I didn't feel like she was validating me. And I said, well, can you understand maybe why? Because, do you think your mom was trying her best? She's like, well, I guess so. I guess I wouldn't have known what to do either as a mom. And so it was really cool to have her and mom in the room and for them to kind of see how each other felt in that situation and just understand that each were doing the best they could at the time with the information that they had. And so now we can say, well, what would you have wanted, your mom or dad to do? And she said, I would have wanted my mom to ask me more questions about it. I'm like, really? Oh, that's really interesting. That's exactly what I would have wanted her to do too. So I would have wanted her to maybe say, what was it like? How did you feel when you saw this ghost? But of course, mom didn't know those things, but now she does. And so it was just really amazing how it opened up the relationship between the two of them, and it didn't have to be this incredible, struggle. even though it was a very sensitive topic. So I'm so thrilled to have one of the certified trainers from the Nonviolent Communication with me today, Roberta Wall, to talk about nonviolent communication, how we can all do this better. And I really think that having these skills is really going to save the world. I know this sounds really dramatic, but seriously, I mean, we really need to learn these skills, and it's not hard. And gosh, you know what? It starts being really fun. So, Roberta, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Karen. I'm already so excited just listening to what you just shared about how important communication is to you and how hard it was for you and how you really put yourself to it. And I'm just excited to be with you.
Thank you. Likewise. Well, let's talk a little bit about first your background. Just how did you get interested in this work? Because obviously you're now a trainer with the Center for Nonviolent Communication, how you heard about it, and then why you decided to, you know, propagate this important, piece of work for worldwide, really.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. First learned about nonviolent communication, I guess, about 20 years ago. And from the beginning, I thought, this is what I've been looking for. And I know so many of us are having that experience in the world today. We're so lucky to live in this time of abundance when so many people are looking for new ways of connecting with themselves and understanding their experience. And there's just so much going on. So I had been very active in peace and social justice causes and the women's movement and anti-racism movement for many, many years, since my teen years, actually. And when I was a little bit older, I got very involved, actually, in the Buddhist spiritual path. And my teacher is Vietnamese Buddhist Thich Nhat Hanh. And I was always looking for ways to bring my inner self-inquiry and my inner transformation together with, you know, the world, and nonviolent communication just presented itself to me, and I thought, this is it, this is the bridge. So just personally in my life, it was a time when I really had a sense in my relationship with my partner and with the rest of my family that I just didn't really know how to reveal my feelings, as you said. And I was keeping it in. So nonviolent communication really spoke to me and continues to speak to me as a way of bringing out what's inside. So that's a little short answer.
Exactly, in a way that people can, it really fosters improved communication and sharing rather than this kind of, I find, either neediness or judgment or, you know, just we were never really taught these things. And that's kind of one of my questions is, like, is this being taught in schools or, you know what I mean, like in organized education at all?
Yes, and not enough. for example, as you may have seen from my website and my blogs, I've been doing a lot of work in other countries, in the Middle East and Africa and South America. And for example, in Israel, when the founder of Nonviolent Communication, Marshall Rosenberg, first went to Israel more than 20 years ago, he was a guest of the Ministry of Education, and they started actually having empathy practice in every kindergarten class in Israel. So it did start, but I don't have a sense that it's continued. And I think that's because what we're seeing more and more is that it's not enough for us to bring these trainings to individuals or to one teacher, to one parent. We have to figure out how to get this into the very structures in our world, you know, the structures that are organizing life and that are holding power. That's the way that I think transformation is going to really happen worldwide. And I totally am part of this movement that's full of passion to change individuals. I mean, we have to. We have to work on ourselves. And I think compassionate communication means saying to ourselves, we're trying to develop these compassionate models, like what you said, like being curious about what's going on with the child, right? We want to do that. We want to bring that love into the world. But if we don't have the support of the structures of the schools, of the structures of the workplaces, it's never going to happen. I mean, right now, teachers don't have the time to stop and give that kind of one-on-one empathy to the children in their classes. Parents don't have the time to do that. Everybody's just trying to survive. And so we need to create institutions that are developed along the same principles of saying the purpose of this institution is to provide care and compassion for a child. That's the only purpose. And
wow.
How do we organize the day around that?
that
you
would
know,
be
that's
utopia.
Yeah, well, it's happening a little bit, from what I understand, in Costa Rica. An NBC trainer took an application of NBC to Costa Rica, and from what I hear, it is being taught in the schools, in every school in Costa Rica. And I think it's interesting that Costa Rica is one of, I think, two countries in the world that doesn't have a military.
Ah.
So there's some connection, again, right, between the vision that the leaders have, the vision and commitment that the leaders have, and then what can happen one-on-one all the way down to the classroom.
Mm. Well, I think that's really interesting what you've talked about, and in a little minute we'll have you give some examples. But I went recently to my medical school reunion, and it was a celebration of its 100th year, since the start, or when are we, 75th year. And what was fascinating is the key speaker, Brian Goldman, is a very famous radio show host now, an emergency room physician at Mount Sinai Hospital. And the whole keynote lecture was about empathy. And I was like floored.
Wow.
And he has this book, talking about, why doctors have basically the secret code, the secret language of doctors. And it's like some of the secret language is not very pleasant or nice to find out about, like gomers. We used to call people gomers, and that's like, get out of my emergency room, because these were like people that were frequent flyers. But he says, let's look beyond the judgment. Let's see, why are these doctors and nurses talking like that? And it's like, they're stressed. They're not getting what they need. They're under-rested, and let's go beyond the judgment. Well, you shouldn't be calling people gomers, and just go, well, let's be empathetic to all involved.
Yeah.
And talking about some of the things they put in place in through the University of Ottawa, through their new Humanities in Medicine program, I was just floored. Like, I really wanted this in medical school. I really pushed for it. I was one of the weird people in class, that was on the curriculum committee trying to change the world. Trying to change, how medical school was taught, and now to see, 20-something years later that it's happening, that at an institutional level, this Humanities in Medicine program is now, they have a sister a university in Shanghai that, the teachers are continuing. I mean, of course, we still need a lot more, skill sets there, but just the intention being there, I think you'd be pretty happy with, if you had heard this lecture.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that, and I would love for you to connect your school and that project with some of the trainers that we have. So, for example, I personally just came back from Botswana, where I did this training with HIV doctors at the Baylor Pediatric Clinic. And it was so incredible. I don't know if people listening know, but Botswana, which is a very historically peaceful and highly educated country in southern Africa, still has a 50% HIV infection rate. And I was called in to give empathy training to these doctors and counselors and who are working with children. It's the pediatric AIDS clinic. And the first session we worked on listening, just as you were talking about your example when you opened up, Karen, about listening to children, I worked first with these doctors on how do you listen to your patients, and starting to work through letting go of judgments when, for example, your teenage patient is telling you that he or she is no longer going to take the medication because they're tired of it. You know, how do you hear into that most painful message? How do you hear their needs? How do you get yourself into a state of curiosity about what is it that's important to you that you're willing to risk your life? You know, and that's where we want to be. That's compassionate communication. What is it that's so important to you that you're doing something that's going to jeopardize your life? What is it that's so important to you that you're doing something that's going to kind of, wow, really impact on what I've dedicated myself to? You know, so this is doctors and parents and teachers. This is how we want to listen. And what we saw very quickly is that there's no way we can listen like that until we fill our own empathy cups. So we spent the whole second session on working on how do we create a climate among the medical and counseling staff so that we're refilling each other's empathy cups. Because, right, there's no way you can listen to scary messages from other people and empathize with things that other people are saying when you're scared to hear what they're saying unless your own cup is completely full of empathy. So most of our nonviolent communication training will start with how do you fill your own empathy cup? And we study and learn a practice called self-empathy. And also we learn more effective strategies for creating empathic outlets within our own community. So for example, at Baylor, I hope they're doing this. I'm waiting to hear the follow-up. They're setting aside times in their staff room when people can go in there to get empathy.
Really?
And then go back out. Yeah, because otherwise you're going to want it from your patient or your child or your spouse or, you know, the very person that's triggering you so that you can't hear with empathy is where you want to get the empathy. That's the tragedy. We get so caught in that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we need to create real sources and resources for us to get filled up. So I would love to bring this to as schools, medical professionals, government people, everywhere.
Yeah.
And we're not taught this. We're not taught this.
No.
It's really tragic. I could go on. And I'll. What else do you want to hear from me?
Well, that is. I'm excited about that, and yes, I'll have to. I have an in at the university. I'm no longer, you know, since being graduated so many years, I'm no longer on the curriculum committee. But I worked for UCLA, you know, as an assistant professor, and would love to be able to shift, you know, some or at least support some of the new kids coming through medical school. Like I was supported by several, you know, very, very amazing mentors. And, I mean, some of the stuff I do is pretty woo-woo, so I'm not sure they're really thrilled necessarily with some of the stuff I do, but I know the kids would be going through there, so
well,
that's exciting.
Yeah, well, you know, and that brings me back to something I was sharing a minute ago, that how do we create institutions that are of empathy and compassion. And I've read things that say that when there are surveys of medical patients, right, when they're asked, you know, what would you like more of? Almost the universal response is better communication from the medical professionals, more compassion from the medical professionals, right? This is what the people you are servicing are asking for.
Wow.
So what is it that prevents those systems from really taking that in? And what we call this in nonviolent communication is the creation of a needs-based system. So as you said earlier, nonviolent communication is based on hearing behind everybody's actions, behind everybody's judgments, to what is it that this living being needs? You know, what is the energy that's coming out, maybe in harsh, scary, unpleasant words, but behind it there's this energy of life that we call needs, right? So if a child, if you say to your child, you know, clean up your room, and they say, no! If we want to practice compassionate communication, we put on these very special ears that we call giraffe ears.
I think that's
and this
funny.
Is a good, it's a good expression for people to keep in mind. Put on your giraffe ears. And what we mean by that is listen the way a giraffe might listen, with those perky little ears and that long neck and that big heart. Listen to what's behind that no. What does that child want? And then instead of, like, getting into a power struggle with them, saying, so is it that you'd like to play longer? Yes. Okay, I could get that. And then if you want to really take on this practice of compassionate communication, you have to say to yourself, you know, the order, the beauty, the efficiency that I want in asking this child to clean their room isn't any more important than his need for play and fun and maybe having a little bit of power in the decisions over him. You know, so that's compassionate communication, is listening for my needs and the child's needs, and then being willing to create a system, a relationship, a plan with that child where everyone's needs are factored in. And this is the same thing we need in institutions. So if the patients in the medical system are saying, we want more empathy, we want more communication about what's going on, we want more support in making decisions. I mean, this is what people want. Well, why don't we create medical systems that value that as much as anything else? And in the end, everybody's going to benefit, right? The more needs of every component of a community that we incorporate into our system, into our decision-making, into our relationships, the more everybody's going to thrive. I don't think anybody doubts that, right?
Right, right. And the thing is, it's just in our society, at least in the Western world, we have not put value. In the West, a lot of it is about where, you know, follow the money trail, you know. And, I mean, nobody's saying, oh, I'm going to prove to you, although I'm sure it can be proved, I'm going to prove to you that focusing and putting it as an important thing, empathy is monetarily valuable to these corporations or whatever it is that's making decisions. But I know some people, like I was just hearing, I think it was Apple, they train their people, you could correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's Apple, they train their people to be good listeners. So the last time I had to call in to talk about my iTunes, or I couldn't figure out how to use my account to save my life. So I was like, okay, how do I pay for this with an iTunes card? I can't figure out which button to push. And the other person was like, oh, that sounds like it could be frustrating, you know. And I was like, whoa, they're doing that thing. That's kind of cool, you know. And they're like, oh, it is my absolute, you know, it's I absolutely want to fix this for you today. I want to make sure that you're happy at the end of this conversation. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool.
And your heart sings, and you're like, I'm going to keep calling Apple, and I'm going to keep buying Apple products because that's the experience I want. Yeah. And so we call this a needs-based system. So the person answering the Apple phone, they want to know, what are your needs? And it's very clear, your need isn't just to get your iPhone fixed. Your need is for connection. Your need is for understanding. Your need is for empathy. People are stressed when they're calling Apple and going into hospital. So it's not only that we value empathy because there's something amazing about empathy. It's that we want to set up systems that are going to value all the needs that people enter into the system to meet. So people enter into the medical system or a call-in online repair system to meet a multitude of needs. So the purpose of the system becomes, if we're using nonviolent communication, the purpose of the system is to meet all those needs, whatever they are. And why else do we need systems? I mean, I think this is what people are asking of our government. You know, I mean, I think this is behind a lot of the kind of so-called anti-government movements. People are like, we don't want a government that's just going to exist for people in Washington. We want a government that's going to exist to meet our needs. And I'm all in favor of that. Now, another principle that we say in nonviolent communication, which has very much to do with communicating compassionately, is that we say that conflict does not occur on the level of the needs, okay, needs for empathy, needs for sustainability of a company or a medical system, needs for efficiency, right, needs for clarity. There's no conflict between empathy and efficiency and sustainability. Conflict only arises when we're dealing with the strategy to meet those needs. So if my strategy, right, if my strategy to meet my need, let's say in the medical system, to meet my need for sustainability, financial sustainability, if my strategy is that doctors only have 5 minutes to talk to the families of a patient, that strategy is in conflict with the need for empathy, okay? So what we want to do is develop strategies. And this goes for institutions, this goes for, you know, our relationships with children and partners. We want to develop strategies that meet everyone's needs. And that is the slogan of nonviolent communication, right? A world that will value and meet everyone's needs. And we're very clear that it's possible, it's doable when we learn to distinguish needs from the strategies to meet the needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely seems much more clear the way you've put it right now.
Good, because, you know, I heard you say in your introduction, it's easy. I'm like, well, it's kind of easy and it's kind of not so easy. Because we've all been raised in societies, cultures, ways of thinking that are something is either good or bad, right or wrong.
Yep,
and
duality.
Compassionate communication is turning that on its head and is saying, actually, no. We don't want to look at things as good, bad, right, wrong. We want to look at them as what's going to meet your need? Can we figure out a way to meet your need in a way that's also going to meet my need?
And another way of looking at this, is it working? You know,
is it working for both of us?
Right.
How's
this
working for both of us?
Yeah.
And we want to always put in, how's this working for both of us? How's this working for everyone affected? So one of the principles of decision making that I love, that I've learned in the nonviolent communication world, is can we create systems and relationships where everyone who is affected by a decision gets to participate in that decision. You know, and I'm about to start a 4-week parenting class here in Asheville, North Carolina, where I moved this year. And I want to present this to parents. You know, can you imagine stretching yourself as a parent to the point where you want to involve your child in every decision that's going to affect them?
Mm-hmm.
And not easy. I don't think this is easy. It's much easier to say, hey, do what I say or you're going to be punished.
Right,
you know,
and a lot of people have heard that growing up.
Absolutely.
You know,
I
do what I say, and it's like, well, you don't do that. Well, you do what I say, not as I do, or I'm the parent here, or, you know, do it or else, or, you know, that's final.
That's right.
You don't have a say in this.
Yeah, exactly. And in the nonviolent communication world, we don't believe in punishment. We believe in meeting needs. So I'm not espousing at all a parenting method, for example. I'm thinking about this parenting class, so I'm using that as an example right now. I don't espouse letting kids do whatever they want to do. with no attention to the parent's needs or a teacher's needs. Now, what I'm saying is, can you as a parent, can you as a teacher acknowledge that you're holding power over this child? Can you acknowledge that you have power over this child? Right? Let's stop pretending that we don't have power.
Mm-hmm.
And then can you acknowledge that the child is going to see you as the holder of power? And that is not going to generate a lot of empathy in the heart of that child, right?
Mm.
You know, let's really look at the dynamic. So then how do we create a relationship with children, for example? But this could be just as much for doctors and patients.
Yep.
You know, this is everybody. There's hierarchy everywhere, right? How do we develop a relationship where we take on the responsibility of building trust that the other person's needs really matter? And the way to do that is to start involving them in the decisions that affect them. So when that child says, I don't want to clean up my room, exactly how you shared in the beginning of this call, you say, so what is it that you would love to do right now?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to give ourselves empathy and work on ourselves so that we're not afraid to ask that. We're not afraid to ask, well, what would you like to do? How would you like to do that? And what we do in our trainings is we look at, so what makes it hard to ask that? And there's so many things that make it hard to ask. You know, well, what would you like to do? Or what would make it hard for you? We're afraid, number one, we're afraid that our needs will never be met. And that we're going to end up, that we will then, quote unquote, have to do what the other person wants, which is completely false. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We're afraid to take responsibility. Yeah. But finding out what the other person's needs are doesn't mean that we have to do what they want us to do. It means that we're going to come in on a higher level of strategizing. We're going to then say, okay, so let's figure out how we can get that for you and get this for me. That's power. To me, that's power. That's leadership. A lot of my trainings I call leadership training, because this is like, I'm going to take 100% responsibility, 100% for getting my needs met in this relationship, for getting my values on the table. That's leadership. So part of my value is I want to include everybody, including me. So that's the first thing, right? We're afraid to ask. We're afraid to get curious. What do you want, right? Because we're afraid it's going to mean that our needs are never going to be met, right? That we're going to abdicate all of our power. That's the first thing. And the second thing is we're afraid that we're going to reinforce some behavior or values that are really scary for us, right? So we're afraid to say this. Exactly, yeah. So, and this is universal. In every relationship, in every system, you know, we're afraid that if we hear what's important to the other person and it's something that we've already decided really isn't wonderful, we're afraid that somehow we're going to, right? We're afraid that somehow
we're
going
to
reinforce. Yeah. And we're going to reinforce really bad, harmful things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's valid, right? So we want to be able to hear what's important to another person in a different way, right? Not in a way that's going to compel us to give up what's important to us, not in a way that's going to limit us to hearing it as that we're reinforcing something that's bad. We have to learn to hear in another way. And that other way is exactly how you started this call, Karen. So what's important to you? So if a teenager is like, can I have the keys to the car and stay out till 4 a.m.? I mean, this is something I hear all the time in my parenting classes.
Oh, okay.
So parents are afraid to say, well, you know, what would you like? Because they know the kids are already going to tell them something that the parent is afraid about.
Right?
I want to take the car and you know, go drinking with my friends, but don't worry, I'll be the designated driver. And, you know, the parents just already, like, totally freaking out for very good reasons. I mean, this is scary, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be able to really be curious about what's important to you about that, and then to develop a relationship where we say, okay, so you want friendship and freedom. Okay. And I want safety. And I want to really feel confident that you're valuing safety the way I'm thinking about it. So how do we do both of those? So you include the child or include the patient or include your spouse, whoever it is, in the communication around what's important to both of you. And then you come up with a solution that's going to meet everybody's needs, which often involves giving, not exerting your power that you have. You know, that is true.
Wow. Wow. But, and if you just, I just want to share, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Roberta Wall from the Center for Nonviolent Communication. We're talking about compassion and compassionate communication and how we definitely need more of this in the world and how it starts with ourselves and some of the things that we can do on a practical basis to really improve our communication and really be empathetic with ourselves as well. And if you'd like to call in and ask about your specific situation and maybe get some tips from Roberta, you can call in live now at 818-514-1190 and hit 1 so we know your hand is up. Again, the number is 818-514-1190 and hit 1. I also have the chat up as well. So if you are just listening online and not on the phone and you're from overseas, you can definitely, I'm trying to figure out how to use the chat because this is new for me, but you can go ahead and type in your question or issue in the chat as well, and I'll let Roberta know that you're there. I do have a couple examples, Roberta, if you're willing to help us out with these couple of examples.
Oh, yes, I'd love to.
Okay, great. Now this is somebody who I know pretty well, actually a couple of them had the same problem because they're friends, and so they get very frustrated with the local kind of governmental people that are in charge of putting the ice on in the Oval, and they have lost two.
Putting the what?
The ice in the ice rink. The local state authorities actually own the Olympic ice rink here in Lake Placid. And the skating oval is from the 1980 and 32 Olympics, so it's a heritage kind of thing. And they had scheduled several competitions that they had to cancel because the state refused to put the ice on, and they were very upset about it because other countries and other states actually put theirs up outdoors as well, even though the temperatures were on the warm side, definitely here, but even in other places that they were warm, they still put the refrigeration on. So they lost a lot of credibility, I suppose, from the people that signed up for these competitions. I mean, 75 people were going to come for the competition. They had to cancel last minute because the ice wasn't up. So both of my friends were very, very frustrated, and they felt completely powerless to do anything about it because this is like them against the state. You know, they could prove to the state that, other people are doing it. Why aren't they? And they, made so much, they made them lose, so much money and investment and time in putting these competitions together, and also the prestige of having it at the Olympic Village. I mean, it was just all this stuff. And so I could feel, just talking to my friends, I could feel the anger, and frustration coming from them. And I totally empathize that it's frustrating dealing with the state because it's like this organization, or lack of organization, depending on who you talk to, of governmental body, that it's not like a person, like a neighbor or, like, they feel like powerless, and they felt like there was nothing they could do. I mean, I suggested, maybe they could write to, the powers that be, and they're like, no, they'll just retaliate, and we can't talk about it in the paper about, how bad it's been because everyone's connected to everyone else, and then they might retaliate against us. So there's a lot of fear there of retaliation. And so they feel really stuck, and I felt so bad for them. I could feel the frustration, and just curious, like, how, you know, the nonviolent communication approach, what would it be the approach? Now, obviously, they do have a person that they can talk to, but if this person decides that they're not going to do it, they're not going to do it. So how would they kind of use nonviolent communication to get both their needs met?
Great example of how do we use communication methods to advocate for ourselves, and how do we use communication principles to create a new kind of relationship where people don't have to fear speaking out, right? I would recommend right off the bat, a three-pronged approach here. And I have, by the way, done a fair amount of things with activists in many countries, as well as with different town boards and on just these issues. So the first thing is, because you ended with saying that these people have this fear of retaliation, right?
Mm-hmm.
That suggests to me that they need to learn to listen to the needs that the board, whoever made the decision, the needs that the decision makers were trying to meet by making this decision.
Mm-hmm.
And this group of concerned activists or, whoever the what do you call the group
athletic
of people?
Organizers?
Okay, so organizers need to do some work amongst themselves before they go and speak to the decision makers, because the first thing they're going to have to do when they go to the decision makers is to hear the needs of the decision makers. And that's not going to be possible until the athletic board people fill their own empathy cup, just like what I said before, right? So otherwise what happens is when they go to talk to the decision makers, their need for empathy is going to come out. And they're going to be like, how did you do this? You know, don't you see what you're doing? And that's not going to lead to anything, right? So that's the great tragedy. Great tragedy is when we go to the very people who have already made it clear that they don't hear our needs.
Right.
And we go
and
to
we
them.
And we want them to.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm defining empathy. I know there's many ways to define empathy, but in this situation, I'm defining empathy as a capacity to really hear and connect with the other person's experience, the other person's feelings and needs. So the decision makers have already made it clear that they're not connected to, they're not valuing in their decision the needs of this group for their reputation, in the worldwide competition, for their hard work, for a slew of things, right? So we don't want to go to them for empathy. However, if we go to them totally depleted from empathy, we won't hear their needs. And then we have the stalemate. That's what a stalemate is. I don't hear
That's
your
what it
needs.
Feels like.
I don't care. Yeah, I don't care about your needs, and you don't care about my needs. I don't care about your needs because you don't care about my needs. You don't care about my needs. This is conflict. This is stalemate.
Well, no, because you're looking. I'm seeing it from their point of view. There's this big organization, and the judgment comes out, and. If I mean, not that they said this to my face, I could feel it, but it was more like they're lazy, they don't care, it's all about politics, all this kind of judgment. And that's the attitude that has been for years between the two groups.
Right. So let me say here, I'm happy to send a worksheet to anybody who wants it who's listening to this show, and including you, of course, Karen. It's called Liberating Your Dream. So if your dream is, let's say, to have the ice put up on time, right? it's a worksheet that'll help you work through it and get to a solution that's going to meet the needs of everybody involved. Because just like you said, if the people who want the ICE show go to the decision makers with this attitude that, you know, they're lazy, they don't care, they're whatever, they're bureaucrats,
right?
There will never be connection. And nonviolent communication is about creating the quality of connection with people who I'm having a hard time doing that, right? Creating the quality of connection so that giving and receiving will be joyful for everyone. So the task of your friends is, what kind of inner work do they need to do as a group to release all of their judgments, reconnect with their needs so that they can go to the decision makers and say, we want to understand what your concerns are, and we want to see if we can come up with a solution that will fully address your concerns. Fully. No compromise. We don't use that word. We're not interested in compromise here. Compromise means everybody ends up unhappy. That's that's not the world that we're going for here.
I don't like that word, actually.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So let's imagine, do you want to work with this a little bit, or do you want to take more
calls? Sure.
Okay, you want to work with it. All right, so let's imagine that we've done our work, our inner work, to connect with, by the way, our own needs and our own frustration and our own despair about this, our overwhelm, everything that we're feeling. But we do this amongst ourselves, not with them. Right? And we give each other empathy. Yeah, we really have this dream of bringing competition here, of honoring the history of the Lake Placid Olympics by, you know, making this happen and all the things that go along with our dream. You know, we reconnect with that. And then we connect with our sadness and our frustration, our anger, that that's not happening. So we have our own empathy circle. And out of that energy of empathy amongst ourselves, for ourselves, we come up with a plan for approaching the decision makers. And we don't approach the decision makers until we really have imagined what their needs are. Okay, so
oh, I see.
What
so
do we,
even if you don't know, you kind of imagine what they could be.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Because we can assume there's not a lot of trust between these two groups right now.
Right.
So we don't want to just go to them and say, what are your needs, right? And think about it. Let's say there's a conflict between spouses, right? And one spouse has said, I can't stand it when you interfere with everything I want to do, right? Let's just say, okay, some of us have ever experienced this. So the other person doesn't want to go to them and say, so tell me what your problem is. I just told you what my problem is. I can't stand you interfering, right? That's not the most effective way. So you want the person to think, so what is it that they really want when they're, you know, yelling? Don't tell me what to do. Oh, they want some more independence or autonomy or trust. And then you go and you make that guess. So when you were saying, don't tell me what to do, don't tell me how to make decisions, is it that you want more trust from me about the decisions you make? Yes. Right. So that's what we want to do. We want to, and this is, you know, a whole training. And by the way, if you go to YouTube, there are hours of Marshall Rosenberg, the founder of Nonviolent Communication, doing trainings in this. And you can get trained in this through YouTube. I mean, it's great to have a trainer. I know a great trainer in Rochester. I don't know how far that is from Lake Placid, but he would be fabulous at this. But
About five hours.
He's really great. He's one of my colleagues.
We're closer to Montreal and Ottawa.
There are definitely, I know a trainer in Ottawa for sure. Okay. I'm not sure if the trainers, and there are trainers in Montreal, I'm not sure if they go into the U.S. to train. There's something about crossing the border to do a training that raises legal issues.
Immigration.
So I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. But definitely ask me to connect you or your friends with trainers living nearby. But anyway, so let's imagine that we are this of the athletic visionaries, and we're doing our work, and we're saying, so, well, what are the needs of the committee who said no? What are their needs? Can you make a few guesses, Karen? Like, what is it that is really important to the people who said, no, we can't do this?
I think that one thing they were saying about the weather is not cold enough, they said, mm-hmm. to do it. So I'm thinking maybe keeping their budget, keeping their budget as low as possible because they're a state and they, might get in trouble if they're overspending inappropriately.
Mm-hmm. So they have limited resources, and they're really worried. They're worried about their resource allocation.
Yeah, I would say money would be a big deal. One might be just, the people that they have, that they might be unhappy if it's unsuccessful. If it doesn't work
mm-hmm.
out, they're going to be blamed. If the weather's bad
mm-hmm.
and the ice is bad, then they're going to look bad because they couldn't do it or they couldn't do it properly. So might as well just not do it at all and say it's
okay.
the weather.
Yeah, so there's some value there of doing something right. If we're going to put something on at the Lake Placid ice rink, we
yep.
want it to be really top notch. We want so there's a value there of maybe integrity that
but upholding
that
a quality maybe that. I mean,
yeah.
I know my friends are probably poo-poo that idea, but I. given the judgments that have been flung across. But I'm just assuming their position and that might be. And I, it's interesting because we had similar issues with my athletic association with the same organization because we have figure skating, not speed skating. And I prayed for the best come as far as who the board members were and, who ended up getting chosen. And it was really interesting what happened because it were the people that did get chosen were the ones that were the smoothest, the ones that were not butting heads with the state that got chosen
mm-hmm.
and voted in. And I thought, well, gee, God must really think this is the best,
mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I kind of went
mm-hmm.
with that. But I was like putting myself in their shoes and going, well, what would it have been? Like, why would they say no? Or why would this be a problem? Why couldn't they schedule this or that or whatever? And I'm thinking, well, if I was giving them the benefit of the doubt, I would say, just like a lot of other people, overwhelmed, overworked,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. underpaid, they're state
mm-hmm.
workers, they don't get
mm-hmm.
listened to by their upper, their upper people. They just get told what to do. And do they ever get appreciated for what
wow.
they do?
Wow. Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, everybody
no.
that I know, my patients
yeah.
that work for the state, they don't get appreciated. So I'm thinking, well, why do I think that these people should receive any better treatment?
Yeah. So now you're really connecting with some beautiful core needs of the people who said no, that maybe they want some appreciation and support. And you said they have this fear of blame. Maybe they're really getting a lot of blame and they're not getting
yeah.
appreciation. And appreciation for their efforts and appreciation for things that may go wrong, but they want to be seen that they tried to do their best, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's with the eyes of the heart that you're now giving voice to. That's the language we would want to go into the meeting with.
Mm.
Now, if your group isn't at the point of doing that, they're not ready to have the meeting.
Right.
And that's
right.
That's a very hard thing to take in because there's some urgency here. But when we are so triggered by our own disappointments.
Yes.
And then our judgments and thoughts about the other people, right? We can't really come from a place of empathy. We can't connect in the way that we want to connect. It just doesn't happen.
And we don't. We don't even think it's possible.
That's right. And that's another thing we need to give ourselves empathy for, I'm sure.
Oh,
A small group, we'll be like, they're never going to listen to us, and there's no time anyway, and what's the point? So we give ourselves empathy by saying, yeah, we're feeling really hopeless and powerless, just like what you said, Karen. We're so frustrated. We really want to make this happen. And it's really upsetting. And by the way, a whole other point, Karen, here is that we want to ask this system that's making decisions, if it was a needs-based system, it would never make a decision that didn't include the needs of all the people who want to use the rink.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole other issue, right? So remember I said in the beginning, three prongs. So the first prong in approaching this is that the people who want to go and advocate and negotiate with the government need to get together as a group and give themselves empathy and understand their own needs and really just let out their frustration, their hopelessness, their powerlessness, let that all out, their fear, and come up with their own needs through that process. Right. So the first thing is just that the group of advocates have to give themselves empathy and identify their own feelings and needs so that they can then go to the decision makers and hear the needs of the decision makers, which is the second prong, and have willingness to come up with solutions that are going to meet everybody's needs. Like they can't go to the power holders and say, We want a system that listens to our needs, and they don't care about the needs of the decision makers, right?
Right.
They just have
the idea of shaming them is probably the worst idea. Which I was very tempted, to be like, why don't you do this? Why don't you go to the paper and say how much money you lost and everything like that? But it didn't feel like that was a good light decision. Because, again, that doesn't address their needs, and maybe they have very good reasons that we don't really know about.
Well, we always want to take out the maybe. They have good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
They are meeting needs that are important to them. And we want to create a relationship where we see the needs that are important to them and they see the needs that are important to us. And then we're going to come up with strategies that meet both sets of needs.
Gotcha.
The conflict is occurring here because everybody's mixing up needs and strategies. So, for example, money, I would say, is a strategy, not a need, right?
Mm.
The strategy of saying, no, we can't open it, it'll cost too much. Okay, that's a strategy to protect some needs. We don't even know what the needs are. We don't know if it's them getting appreciation as a group of decision makers, as you mentioned. We don't know if it's sustainability. We don't know what the needs are. So we want to do our work of releasing our judgments, and I have all kinds of worksheets I could send to you and to people who are listening. If you just email me, we could give people my website. I have worksheets on how to work through judgments so that you can come up with your needs, on how to give yourself empathy on the spot so that you can be open to the other person's needs, okay? I mean, it's not easy. None of this is easy. And
no,
we're living in
no.
systems that don't give us the time or space to do this. So we really have to strong intention to create connection.
What is your personal website or your business website, Roberta? Because I know we have less than a minute left live. So.
Oh, darn. Okay. It's
we can keep going.
This is great. It's www.steps, STEPS, numeral 2, peace, PEACE.com. So
Ooh.
steps, how-topeace.com. And I also have a blog. So if you want to write to me to get these worksheets, it would be info@steps2peace.com. But I just want to throw in, so remember I said three prongs for this group. The first one is they get together amongst themselves and give themselves empathy and really connect with their needs so that they can open to the needs of the decision makers. Then the second one would be going to the decision makers with the willingness and intention of connecting with their needs and coming up with solutions that will meet everybody's needs. And the third prong is our long-term goal that we have to start working on now of creating needs-based systems so that decisions aren't made that don't factor in the needs of the people organizing events for the rink, the public, right? We need to get back to creating needs-based systems. Systems were formed, the needs of everybody involved in them. But then over time, the systems evolved away from that, and now they tend to just meet the needs of one part of the system. You know, usually could be the people who, yeah, exactly. So three-pronged approach. I'm happy to take emails from people and to continue this dialogue. So
that is so awesome.
Wonderful,
Roberta.
Talking to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this has been great. And that's, that was the most kind of most, that situation was the most volatile, I would say, that I have come up with this past week that just popped into the top of my head. I said, well, these people could definitely use some help. So thank you so much. It's great to have a real life example, you know, in addition to some of the stuff we talked about earlier, and you just put that into practice. And thank you also, too, for letting people know about all the wonderful YouTube videos that are out there. People want to study this more. I think it's so crucial, like you said. And even if we just, you know, work on our own families or ourselves or whatever, I found it so incredibly valuable. So, again, thank you so much, Roberta, for your time and the work you do.
Thank you, Karen, and I hope that we stay in touch.
All right, we will. Take care, everyone.
All right.
Thanks for listening in. Thank you, Roberta. Bye for
Thanks,
now.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.